Welcome to The World Below, The War in the Heavens, a podcast exploring the adventure, the intrigue, and the magic of a land that lies beneath the celestial battle between gods and demons, a clash that has gone on since time immemorial. I'm your guide, your interlocutor, and your host, Michael Pryor. Welcome, everyone, to episode 29 of The World Below, The War in the Heavens podcast, the ninth of season three. This one is all about Daimon II of Anarquist, the pious king. The overview. King Daimon II, 442 to 445, was born in the year 412 and raised in Brel, the realm in the far north of the continent, on the Great Northern Gulf. It's a tropical and lush land that his grandfather had fled to after Grippina the Cruel usurped the throne of Anarquist. Daimon's birth name was Blemon, after the 3rd century Anarquistian monarch King Blemon, one of the renowned Vafanite monarchs. He chose to change it to Daimon upon taking the crown in honour of his father. This was, and has remained, unusual, with very few Anarquistian monarchs taking regnal names like this. As a young man, Blemon followed his father into the military, showing aptitude and loyalty alongside his younger brother, Hotch. He excelled in swordplay and gained a reputation for a dazzling style, but he was judicious with his aggression. He's recorded as advising to cool off more hot-headed contemporaries. There's battle lines being drawn. Nobody's right if everybody's wrong. He fought with his father and brother in a number of important battles and was instrumental in repelling the Anarquistian Navy's exploratory raid on Egburn, capital of Brel, in 427. More importantly, he was vital in the famous Battle of Tegemain Pass, where Queen Kesca's plans for conquering the continent were smashed. He moved to Anarquist with his father and brother in 429, when his father took the crown. When his father died in the year 441, Blemon was crowned king at the age of 30 as King Daimon II. King Daimon II ruled as wisely as his father, while Anarquist prospered in peace. He was greatly assisted by his brother Hotch, who was a trusted advisor and, perhaps unusually for a trusted advisor, actually didn't betray him. After something of a personal crisis, Daimon II became pious and granted much freedom and many rights to the temple. Perhaps this was timely, as one of the major events in his reign was the rise of the Seer, a prophet of zealous sort, who came out of the desert wilderness and gathered a considerable following. The Seer's prophecies were keenly sought, and Daimon granted her several audiences before her disappearance in 444. Daimon died in 445, aged only 33, taken by an illness that swept the continent, a plague of a sort unknown at that time, but something that would reappear in waves throughout the history of the world below the war in the heavens, where it has universally been known as the Red Fever. Perhaps because of his short reign and his attention on matters spiritual rather than temporal, Daimon II left no cylinder in the Library of Souls and only a brief record in the annals. Most of the detail of his realm comes from the account that his successor left in the same place, as since Daimon II had no children, his brother Hotch succeeded him and followed his brother's example by taking the name Daimon and becoming Daimon III. Reign highlights. A reign of 3 years, more or less, isn't a long time to rack up many highlights, but if I've learned anything in unpacking the Anarquistian monarchs, it's that things happen when they're around. Ambitious, talented, sometimes headstrong, and almost always noteworthy, they tend to be in the middle of substantial affairs. In the overview, I've already alluded to the major affairs for King Daimon II involving spiritual matters, one way or another. Which is interesting because as a young man he gave no indication that religion played any part in his life at all. Along with his father Daimon I and his brother Hotch, he attended the major festivals at the Prime Temple, but that was about all. He devoted himself zealously to military matters first, and then, after the throne was restored to his family, he was a staunch advisor to his brother on all sorts of mundane matters like water supply and taxation. It wasn't until a year and a bit into his reign that what might be called a conversion occurred. If not a conversion, then some sort of religious awakening, perhaps. Early in his reign, Daimon II made sure that he was a monarch to be seen. By that, I mean he regularly went on tours of Aniquist, and not just in the city, but in the towns and settlements across the realm. He'd travel with a retinue, of course, including a sizable force of soldiery, but he soon gained the reputation of being a king who'd stop and talk to the common folk. Many an inn and tavern hundreds of miles from the capital bear a sign to the effect that King Daimon II ate, drank, or slept here after a visit, and his generosity to local causes became widespread knowledge. It was on one of these processions that a remarkable event occurred. After leaving the town of Aachen in the southwest of the realm, and on the way to Majonica, a day's travel away on the coast, a boom split the air. King Daimon was leading the 100 or so people when he was struck a glancing blow on the shoulder, and he toppled from his horse. A few yards away, a hideous shrieking squawk erupted, and a giant hookbeak bird fell next to King Daimon, its head a bloody mess. Chaos momentarily ensued. Soldiers wheeled and scattered, certain that an assassin must be close by. Retainers rushed to the king, who was sitting up by this time in pain and staring at the carcass of the flightless bird and holding his arm close to his body. It soon became clear that the something that had struck the king had continued on its way and nearly decapitated the hookbeak bird that had been about to spring on the king with its beak and slashing talons. Some investigation found that something was buried in the ground not far from the corpse of the hookbeak bird. Considerable effort was needed, but eventually something heavenly was unearthed, a fist-sized scale, argent, and immediately estimated to be of supreme puissance. When his arm was comfortable in a sling, King Daimon declared thanks to the heavens for saving his life. It was obvious to him that the blow to the shoulder was to alert him, and then the formidable threat was dispatched, and that was a clear sign that the heavens were protecting him, and all the more special, because Heavenfalls rarely took such personal action. Almost all Heavenfalls fell relatively gently, too, settling like leaves in autumn. This one, however, struck with the swiftness of an arrow, so deadly was the peril. Daimon was convinced that he was favoured by the gods. King Daimon honoured his commitment to visit Majonica, but shortened his stay and rode for Aniquist and the Prime Temple. Thereafter, King Daimon rarely missed a temple service and generously sponsored temple initiatives, especially missionaries to the inland wilderness. Soon people began to speak of him as Daimon the Pious, usually in a tolerant manner, like one would talk about an uncle who's taken up a new, slightly eccentric hobby. At this point in the 5th century, the temple was well established and was well embedded in the society and culture of Aniquist. Less so across the continent, but it certainly had a robust presence throughout the world below the war in the heavens. With Daimon's backing and approval, however, the temple entered a phase of growth, as well as a period of increasing riches. Daimon granted land to the temple throughout Aniquist city and throughout the realm. The temple used these for, naturally, temples, but it also became a substantial landlord. After building commercial premises and leasing them out, riches begetting riches, so to speak, and riches then begetting power and influence. King Daimon's sudden interest in religious matters and religious affairs were interpreted by some, even within the temple, as Aniquistian cunning, using religion as a means to further power. After all, many had joined the temple for just that reason. However, his continued non-interference in temple affairs suggested otherwise. His interest was generally on humbler matters, with ongoing support for missionaries and a readiness to fund the establishment of local temples in small towns and villages, not just in Anquist, but across the continent. Some of these still exist in the present-day world below the war in the heavens, and all of them have a small plaque in the front vestibule noting that the temple was built on the orders of King Daimon II in order to praise the heavens more fully. King Daimon's religious devotions also evince themselves in early 444 when he funded and equipped an expedition to try to establish if a heavenfall in the shape of a giant head truly existed. The scale head was generally held to be a traveller's tale, a legend without foundation. But King Daimon had had several scholars from the Library of Souls poring over old manuscripts, and, while sceptical, he felt enough evidence existed for a well-funded mission to see what was what. He persuaded his close friend Iduma Prengold to head the party, and it was a sizeable team, 3 or 4 dozen experts, well-equipped and with a top-quality unit from the Anaquistian army for support and defence. The expedition left Anaquist with copies of old maps and more copies of travellers' journals, diaries that spoke of seeing the giant head near distinctive red cliffs or on the edge of a vast salt sea. The party spent half a year combing the parts of the inland wilderness where the giant head was said to be, before returning unsuccessfully, but with more travellers' tales that insisted the giant head was true, but in an entirely different part of the vast inland. Iduma Prengold begged for more money and more backing for a second expedition, but King Daimon declined, fearing that his good friend had returned touched by his hardships and was struggling with reality. He appointed Prengold as head of the Household Cavalry, a new unit alongside the palace guard, personally faithful to the monarch of the day. The Seer. Early in 443, reports began to emerge of a young wandering preacher moving from town to town on the western edge of the realm of Anaquist. Now, this sort of thing was far from unusual in the world below the war in the heavens. Having constant proof of another world, having artifacts falling to earth from the heavens, certainly encouraged those of, shall we say, an otherworldly frame of mind. Those with matters spiritual to the forefront were validated with every heavenfall, and some of them took to a life of spreading what they saw as the word. Before the rise of the temple, this meant a multiplicity of interpretations were abroad, depending on the individual leanings of whoever was doing the word spreading. With the establishment of the temple, a common doctrinal core began to be established, and the more fringe elements died down. Not died out, as the continuing history of the world below the war in the heavens is full of heretics, splinter sects, revisions of dogma, and so on, but settled down somewhat. So in this 5th century, a wandering preacher wasn't rare. Some gathered following, some didn't. The temple's approach at this time was, generally, tolerant. If a preacher became overly popular, they were often recruited and given a position, so their personal following was swallowed up into the general temple congregation, and all was good. If they resisted this, and most didn't, they usually disappeared. The preacher we're talking about didn't follow the usual pattern, however. They gained a following, a reasonable one, among the farmers, woodcutters and prospectors in the far west of Anaquist, but in a dramatic shift, gave up preaching the word of the heavens and instead began to hand down prophecies. Again, rare but not unknown. Oracles, self-appointed and hailed by many, appear throughout the history of the world below the war in the heavens. Abelard of Ing in the Eastern Mountains wrote a slim, cryptic text dated to the year 99, purporting to predict the events in the reign of Kenil I, 113-199. But since later historians suspect that this text was actually written in the year 211, little account is given to Abelard of Ing. Isaura the Arenthian was often sought for her oracular pronouncements in the late 3rd century, and fortunes were reputed to have been made and lost, depending on how these pronouncements were interpreted. The preacher in Western Anaquist, soon dubbed the Seer, settled in a cave on the banks of the Denbin River, near the town of Denbridge, and was visited for her prophecies, which at the time were of a particularly local and helpful kind, predicting the weather, the river flow, and, importantly, any raiders in the area. Denbridge, being on the fringes of Anniquist, was vulnerable to raids from the wilderness and had suffered in the past. The seer's warnings proved to be remarkably accurate, as were her weather and river forecasts. Skeptics suggested that most of her predictions were merely good guesses based on observation, and that she had informants from likely raiders, letting her know in advance of movements in the area. But none of this stopped her stream of visitors and, perhaps, worshippers. Eventually, the temple took notice and sent an examiner from the prime temple to investigate. When the examiner hadn't returned after a month, another, more senior examiner was sent, who reported that the first examiner had stayed and become a virtual acolyte of the seer, adopting a role as her personal assistant and bodyguard. The temple made the usual offer to the seer to join its ranks, but she declined. More pressure was about to be brought to bear on her, but the king intervened, inviting her to an audience at the palace. All Anniquistian monarchs from the founder onwards understood the importance of an intelligence network within the realm and without, to keep apprised of developments that they needed to be aware of in case action was required. King Daimon was no different, but, according to Tai Dao in his book Spirituality During the Anniquistian Restoration, 2016, his network was given the extra responsibility to monitor events of a religious nature. This could have brought the king into conflict with the temple, which naturally kept a close eye on these matters throughout the continent, but the king had generally not made a fuss about this. The king's invitation to the seer, however, was more than monitoring. Some in the temple saw it as interfering in matters spiritual, and they were even more concerned when the seer's audience with the king resulted in her being offered a position at court, which she accepted, a contrast to her rebuffing of the temple's offer of a position. Within weeks of arriving at court, the seer was part of the king's advisory council, and fears were held about her influence. These fears were allayed when her prophecies remained confined to the areas of weather and river flows, her foresight about raiders apparently failing her as she moved away from the border regions. Gradually, though, she became morose and uncommunicative, and more and more unhappy in the city. Upon her request, Daimon II allowed her to sequester herself in a remote temple institution in the far east of the realm. When she died of consumption in late 444, he built a fountain in her memory in Lowtown, representing her as a blindfolded water carrier. Minor Rebellion, known as the Confederacy of Dolts. Late 444 was also the time for an incident that is indicative of a certain type of historical moment. We often hear of great events, overthrows, wars, important social and cultural revolutions, and more history brings us important domestic histories about the way people actually lived. But one type of event rarely registers in the pages of history, and that's because they're almost insignificant. They barely cause a blip despite what might seem like ominous beginnings. The minor rebellion known as the Confederacy of Dolts is one of those. Every ruler has those who are unhappy with their rule. The malcontents, those with real or imagined grievances, the ambitious. Daimon II was no exception, but the rebellion that occurred in late 444 was so inept, the rebels so feckless, that it began, rose, and fell apart with hardly any impact at all on Anniquist and its people. It fully earned its nickname, the Confederacy of Dolts. For your information, I'm getting most of the narrative here from Bathsheba Muldoon's book, The Confederacy of Dolts. It was published in 1988, and to my mind, there has been nothing more accurate, more acute, nothing more comprehensive, nothing better written since. The ringleaders of the Confederacy of Dolts were an unlikely pair. Apart from being in their early 30s, they had little in common. Aegidius Lallon was from a rich old Anniquistian family, the second child of Euclid Lallan and Polyxena Fedmar. Syra Quegg, on the other hand, was the oldest child of Dominica Quegg, who was one of Queen Kesca's guard and was killed at the Battle of Tegemain Pass. Syra Quegg was not rich, and when she met Egidius Lallan, she was working as a farmhand at the Lallan family estate. One way or another, they got talking, and soon Egidius's incipient feelings of resentment and mistrust were being fanned by Syra's seething bitterness at the way her mother's employer and mentor had been overthrown. She wanted nothing less than the overthrow of King Daimon, and Egidius went along with that. Soon they had recruited an inner cabal of rebels committed to the cause by way of talking to people in bars and taverns. With Egidius's money, Syra leased an old farmhouse just outside the outskirts of Lowtown, where one of their co-conspirators proudly chalked "Rebel Headquarters" over the front door. It remained there for days before Syra saw it and had it rubbed out. Then she used a stick to instruct the inner cabal on the need for secrecy. Bruised and with nasty splinters, they saw reason. Meanwhile, convinced that a small, committed and well-equipped army would be needed to overthrow the king, Egidius went about recruiting on a large scale. Throwing money around like water, dozens were soon flocking to the rebel headquarters, ready to be inducted in what Syra was calling the Army of the Just and True. Word got around, and dozens of recruits soon became hundreds. Tents were erected, weaponsmiths' forges were running night and day. Recruits were slapped into something like a fighting force. Naturally, none of this went unnoticed by authorities. After the fall of Queen Kesca, King Daimon I had purged and modernised the Anaquistian army. The king's intelligence service liaised closely with this new army, which in 444 was commanded by Fausta Shanfoot. Spies had been keeping her well apprised of the minor rebellion. It posed no threat. The hundreds of recruits had become dozens again, as many took their sign-on money and scarpered quicksmart, before some signed up again, since the rebels' record-keeping wasn't all that it could be. But Shanfoot made sure that she had several of her trusted people recruited to be on the inside. Soon stories emerged of lack of food, lack of water, lack of weapons, and an almost complete lack of discipline among the rebels. Each evening, the entire cohort was harangued by either Syra or Egidius. Syra's tirades lasted for hours and woe betide any rebel whose attention wandered. Flaming with anger, she itemised her personal grievances over and over before listing the perceived failings she saw in the king and his regime. She extolled the glory days of Queen Kesca and her immediate forebears, something that very few of the recruits seemed to agree with. Egidius's speeches were just as long, interminable descriptions of how he'd been mistreated, how he'd been overlooked, how he had trouble making friends, all in a voice that was described as intensely whiny. The top secret but widely known date for the rebels' march on the capital was the first day of summer. Some would say a propitious day, looking forward to good weather and fine times, but it wasn't to be for the rebels. The rebel army by this time consisted of something under 100 soldiers, most of whom would rather have been elsewhere. It took some fearsome tongue-lashing from Syra before the troops were in order and emerging from the gates of the farmhouse, where they met a force of 1,000 strong, a special detachment of the Anaquistian army under Commander Shanfoot. Called upon to surrender, most of the rebels couldn't do it fast enough, flinging weapons to the ground, dumping shields and unbuckling armour. The air rang with metal clashing on metal, and not in a sword-fighting way. Egidius was mounted on his favourite horse, a sleek grey gelding. He looked at Syra, who stood in the stirrups, swung her sword and cried, "You'll never take us alive!" Egidius seemed to be taken aback by the plural, but shrugged and followed as Syra turned her horse and plunged into the woods. Not having done any reconnoitering at all, another military shortcoming, the countryside around their headquarters was unknown to this pair of ringleaders. Before going far, Egidius's horse pulled up, and Egidius, who hadn't been paying attention, was thrown and landed in a large quicksand bog, where he quickly perished. Syra managed to escape pursuit and fled to the northeastern highlands. She attempted to start a gang of bandits there, but no one would join. She was reduced to stealing from the many chicken farms in the area, and when running from one with a clutch of eggs in her hands, she was surprised by a 6-foot-tall hook-beak bird, who presumably saw the eggs and exacted revenge on behalf of a cousin. Syra Quegg was disemboweled on the spot. The Confederacy of Dots is rarely mentioned in any discussion of Anaquistian history, except as the butt of jokes, but is worth looking at as a diversion and an example of how even the most bungling can end up in charge of an army if they have enough self-belief. Personal life. Diamond II married Alcyone Omwok in 420 when he was only 18 years old. She was a famous beauty and famously headstrong, but much admired. She continued to call him Blemon after he took the regnal name of Diamond, the only person to do so. They had 3 children, Hermia, born in 420, Athanasius, born in 421, and Gloriana, born in 424. King Diamond chose his successor days after his coronation in 442, and he did so by setting his children a task: to write an explanation of why they should be his successor. Diamond judged that Athanasius's effort was the best. Not the longest, Gloriana wrote a lengthy essay describing her many achievements in command positions in the navy, nor was it the most eloquent. Hermia wrote a long lyric poem full of allusions and flattery, comparing her father to the gods. But Athanasius's effort was the only one that mentioned the people. He wrote about governance and representation, fair taxation and municipal services that he'd improve, matters that his sisters dismissed as boring. Immediately after the decision, Hermia took herself off to Perun, where she had modest success publishing her own poetry, while Gloriana died in 444, commanding a Benthian fleet, defending against Vesbessali pirates. Diamond has been described by contemporaries as tall but thin, which seems to be an understatement. He was widely considered as gaunt all his life, and despite many varied diets prescribed by doctors, he could never put on weight. He had an interest in dogs, particularly races, and always had 2 or 3 pets nearby. Diamond II died in his sleep in 444, aged only 33. Doctors could find no obvious cause of death, and he was much mourned. Final words. King Diamond II, the pious one. A steady hand at the tiller, and Anaquistian history has few enough of these that we truly need to value them more. And that's all for Diamond II. Next on the World Below the War in the Heavens podcast, it's Diamond III. Farewell, and may the heavens smile upon you. This has been The World Below the War in the Heavens, a podcast exploring the history, culture, and esoterica of the world below, a continent of magic and mystery with inhabitants who keep one eye on the sky at all times. I've been your host, Michael Pryor. If you'd like to find out more about me and my books, pop over to www.michaelpryor.com.au. Farewell!